It's the NPR News Update for Thursday, December 18. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Ahead, Minnesotans and businesses with Cuba ties react to the move by President Obama yesterday. Is Minsure working for insurance companies? What's next for the Minneapolis School Board as it searches for a new leader? And we hear from Minnesota Steel Drums. First, the state's unemployment rate has dipped again. State economic officials say employers added 6,600 jobs in October, and the unemployment rate dropped 0.2%. The state unemployment rate is now at 3.7%. State economic officials say exports of Minnesota-made products grew faster than the U.S. total for the 3 months ending in September. Matt Sepik reports.
The Department of Employment and Economic Development says exports from Minnesota reached $5.5 billion in the third quarter. That's up 5.8% over the same period last year, well ahead of the U.S. rate of 4.2%. Canada remains Minnesota's largest international trading partner by far, followed by Mexico and China. Exports to China dipped slightly, but those to Mexico grew by more than half. The state says fiber optic products and medical instruments led overall export growth. Foreign sales of ore and oil were each up around 150%, driven by demand from Canada. Exports of machinery and vehicles were down slightly. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Auto and business lending is on the rise at the state's 129 credit unions. Martin Moylan has more.
Business lending grew nearly 15% from the same quarter a year ago, hitting $1.2 billion. Meanwhile, auto lending rose 8% to $3.2 billion. Mark Cummins is president of the Minnesota Credit Union Network.
People are starting to see rebounds in their housing values. So some of those base things that as a consumer make you feel more comfortable to make another big purchase.
Used vehicles accounted for nearly three-quarters of the value of the auto loans. The state's credit unions have seen their combined assets increase every year since 2007. The organizations have about 1.6 million members. Some people belong to more than one credit union, however. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A nonprofit is offering a new way for Minnesotans to track how much health care costs. Minnesota Community Measurement tracks health care cost and quality. It has now added to its website new clinic total average cost per patient numbers. President Jim Chase says the information offers healthcare consumers a broad glimpse into expense and quality from clinic to clinic.
I think people need to look at the information, see how it would inform them about is this a good value for them, whatever group that they're looking at.
The nonprofit started posting healthcare quality ratings on its website 10 years ago. The group is funded by the state and federal government, along with money from the healthcare industry. Cuban Americans are weighing in on President Obama's announcement yesterday the U.S. will restore relations with Cuba. Many live in Minnesota, as Peter Cox reports.
In 1990, Felix Verseguis, then 26, set out on a 90-mile journey to freedom.
So how did you end up leaving?
Oh, I left on the inner tube from Cuba with two other friends.
You guys were on an inner tube?
Yep. So it took me like about 5.5 days.
Through storms and an often relentless sun, Verseguis and his friends paddled three inner tubes tied together toward Florida. They were finally picked up by a boat and later a helicopter just off the coast. 24 years after his painful journey, Verseguis, who now teaches Spanish at North Hennepin Community College, was happy to hear the president's plan to open an embassy in Havana.
There have been so many years of this tension between the two countries, and I think that if they move in that direction, it's going to be good for both countries.
President Obama said the policy of isolation between the United States and Cuba has failed and announced a plan to ease travel restrictions and increase trade between the two countries. In Minnesota, around 3,600 people identified themselves as Cuban in the last census. The census estimates roughly 1,000 of them were born there. One of the state's most famous Cuban Americans, Minnesota Twins great Tony Oliva, was ecstatic when he was told the news yesterday while he was at the gym.
I say, oh my goodness, God knows. I've been waiting for that for 50 years. I think that's beautiful.
Oliva says he thinks opening travel between Cuba and the United States will help establish friendly relations between the countries. For Joe Nunez, who was born in Cuba but moved to Minnesota when he was a toddler, Wednesday's news reminded him of arguments he had with his mother at their South Minneapolis kitchen table in the 1970s.
My mother, as one of the generation who felt that the Castros had stripped what she loved of her country, was fairly vehement that the country be isolated. From a fairly early age, we would push back.
Nunez, then a teenager, understood her position, but thought opening things up would be better.
Those of us who are in younger generations, for good or bad, we don't have the visceral hatred of the Castro regime that many of our parents and grandparents sincerely had, and there's reason for that.
He says he thinks younger Cuban Americans are more supportive of a new approach.
I was pleased that within my lifetime, at least, we're having a more constructive dialogue about Cuba and how our countries should respect each other.
57-year-old Roberto Fonts runs a communications business in St. Paul. He came to the United States in 1980 during the mass emigration from Cuba called the Mariel Boatlift, and he moved to Minnesota soon after. Yesterday was an emotional day for him.
I actually had tears in my eyes. I was crying. It was a huge emotional message. I mean, this is something I've been expecting to hear for a long time.
Font says the announcement could help push Cuba toward being a free nation.
So this is a very profound step towards a world that works for everybody.
Obama's plan to normalize relations with Cuba does have its critics, including many Republican lawmakers who say they'll resist lifting the trade embargo that's been in place for more than 50 years. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The normalization of Cuba-U.S. relations is drawing praise from some Minnesota companies. With about 11 million people, Cuba's not a big market, but farm interests in Minnesota want to see it open up even more. Mark Stile reports.
U.S. trade sanctions against Cuba have been in place for more than 50 years, ever since Fidel Castro led the communists to power on the island nation. There has been some relaxation of the trade ban through the years, but never enough to allow for anything close to normal economic relations. One Minnesota company that has been working to change that is Twin Cities-based Cargill, one of the nation's largest food and commodity companies. Cargill Vice President of Corporate Affairs Devery Bufner-Vorwerk says the presidential announcement was welcome news.
For Cargill, we were quite pleased and encouraged. We have been working for quite some time to end the embargo on Cuba, and for us, we really saw this as just a historical moment.
But she says the announcement is just the first step in reestablishing free trade between the two countries. Obama made some small adjustments in the embargo, but most of it remains in place.
The president was able to make some changes by executive order today, but in order to end the embargo, it would take Congress stepping in and actually repealing it.
With few exceptions, such as some medicine, farm goods, and telecommunications equipment, no products, technology, or services may be exported from the United States into Cuba, either directly or through third countries. And even though the embargo remains on the books, two Cuban-American U.S. senators criticized the administration's action, including New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez, who chairs the Foreign Relations Committee until the GOP takes over the chamber next year. But Cargill promises to keep pushing for a repeal of the embargo. Southeast Minnesota farmer Ralph Kaler also wants to see that happen. Kaler sold livestock to Cuba soon after trade sanctions were eased about 15 years ago. There's even a photo of him talking with then-Cuban leader Fidel Castro. He says the embargo restricts his ability to sell into a new market.
It just doesn't make sense. We're much better off trading with them.
Kaler's last sale to Cuba was about 4 years ago. Total Minnesota farm sales to Cuba have also declined. In 2012, state farmers sold Cuba about $27 million worth of corn, soybeans, and other products. It's estimated that number declined by a quarter in 2013. The state's farmers and food companies believe ending the embargo would reverse that trend. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
MinSure touts dramatic increases in public and private health care plan enrollments through the online marketplace over the past several days. But one insurance carrier is complaining MinSure is providing poor data and placing the health plan at a competitive disadvantage. Mark Zdechlik reports.
The good news for MinSure and its budget is that the expected surge in health plan signups came through in the run-up to the original Monday deadline. That day, the agency pushed back the deadline to enroll in coverage effective January 1st to this coming Saturday. MinSure reported a 32% jump in total enrollments between Saturday and Tuesday. Total enrollment of more than 49,000 so far is split about evenly between private and government-sponsored plans. MinSure CEO Scott Leitz told a board meeting yesterday MinSure's systems are stable and holding up despite the surge in enrollments, unlike last year.
And the nice thing is that given the volume that we've been getting both on the call center side, but then also through website traffic, performance has been pretty good.
While the call center and the software appear to be functioning well, MinSure officials acknowledged a major problem remains: getting individual enrollment information to their insurance carriers. An automatic process to transfer the data still does not work. Joel Euland from UCare told the board UCare has received no workable data from the exchange and cannot issue new policies.
This puts UCare in an awkward position. We are responding to customer services calls from our new enrollees. They're looking for member ID cards. They're looking for other information for coverage that's effective on January 1st of 2014. And we don't know who they are.
Euland also expressed concern that information on cancellations is not available either. He says that might lead to some customers getting charged next year for both their new health plan and the one they left. That scenario, Euland said, could really hurt customers.
We know that many of our members do not have a lot of extra money sitting in their checking account. An extra withdrawal could lead to members seeing unexpected overdrafts in their checking account.
Board members pressed MinSure staffers about why the data transfer mechanism is still not working. They considered a motion requiring regular staff reports on new operational statistics, but decided against that to leave it up to staff to come up with their own proposed measurements by the board's next meeting in early January. MinSure CEO Scott Leitz also said diverting staff time to develop a status report could be counterproductive and hurt MinSure's ability to fulfill its primary mission.
I think we can hopefully pluck some of the low-hanging fruit fairly quickly. I think some of these are going to be a little trickier. I think that there, you know, certainly at a staff level, we made some decisions that it was important that we devote as many resources as we can to the build-out of the system.
Despite the data transfer problems, UCare is urging MinSure to further extend its enrollment deadline beyond Saturday. UCare is only offering plans through the exchange and said having its sales cut off on Saturday when commercial carriers are selling outside of the exchange through December 31st puts UCare at a competitive disadvantage. MinSure announced no change to its new December 20th deadline, but Leitz indicated it is not out of the question. But some oppose another extension, including John Freeman at Health Access Minnesota, which helps people find coverage on MinSure. Freeman welcomed the extension of the deadline from midnight Monday until Saturday afternoon. He says the extra days are allowing Health Access to help more people make it through the process of getting insurance through MinSure. But Freeman says another extension is a bad idea, given the problems insurance companies are having getting the information they need.
I'd prefer that it stay at the 20th at this point, because I think it does give us ample time to get people through the process.
And Freeman said he does not want another extension to aggravate problems getting bills and insurance ID cards to people who've already signed up. Mark Zdechlik, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
The Minneapolis School Board has begun the process of finding a new superintendent. Bernadia Johnson is leaving the district's top job at the end of January. The board is expected to initiate a nationwide search, but some are already saying the district should consider hiring one of its own. Tim Post has more.
Bernadia Johnson hasn't talked publicly about her abrupt resignation, but in a statement she said personal reasons played a role. She's caring for an aging grandparent and said that's making it difficult to fully commit herself to the challenges she faces as superintendent. Those challenges include a stubborn achievement gap between white students and students of color, as well as stagnant test scores. Board leaders maintain leaving was Johnson's choice, and that members did not ask for her resignation. The district's CEO, Michael Gore, will step in as interim superintendent. Gore says he's disappointed to see Johnson go, but thinks new leadership might also bring new opportunities.
as we go through this transition, we see this as an opportunity to refocus, re-energize our commitment to public education.
Gore says candidate interviews may not begin until next fall, with an eye toward having a new superintendent in place by 2016. As far as whether he wants to be one of those candidates, Gore isn't saying just yet.
I will certainly explore that in the future, but right now my job is to really provide leadership of our staff.
As interim superintendent, Gore's main job will be to move ahead with an ambitious plan to close the achievement gap in Minneapolis by 2020. The plan focuses on boosting student test scores, improving attendance, and giving some schools the freedom to try new and innovative approaches. Don Samuels will join the Minneapolis School Board in January. Samuels, a former Minneapolis City Council member, won a seat on the board in November. Samuels wants to cast a wide net for the next superintendent, but says Gore should be included.
We'll be conducting a nationwide search, but I think he deserves a very, very close look.
Before becoming the CEO of Minneapolis Public Schools, Gore was the executive director of Generation Next, an organization working with the St. Paul and Minneapolis school districts to narrow the achievement gap. Former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback now heads that organization. Ryback thinks Gore would be a good fit in the school district's top slot.
I think it's important for every option to be looked at, but Michael Gore brings some exceptional qualities.
Ryback is impressed with Gore's rise through education. Born in South Korea, he moved to Minneapolis at age 10 and graduated from Washburn High School. Gore worked in the Minneapolis School District, then took administrative jobs in the Memphis and Boston districts before coming back to Minnesota to head up Generation Next. Ryback says Gore's combination of experience in Minneapolis and elsewhere make him well-suited to push the district's effort to close the achievement gap.
The plan is in place. We need to get that done and implemented, and Michael's a doer.
Another fan of Gore's is Lynn Nordgren, the president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. Nordgren says Gore already has a good working relationship with union members.
He was just with about 100 teachers last week, listening to them and the issues that we have in our schools. And he's a great listener. He's a great thinker. And we're looking forward to great things.
Even if Gore is a natural fit, districts the size of Minneapolis typically do broad national searches when a superintendent position opens. The Minneapolis School Board will decide in coming weeks on how to proceed. Members say they want to involve the community in the decision as well. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention Act will not become law. While it did pass the House last week, the bill did not win approval in the Senate. The bill would have provided more money for mental health treatment and transitional support for veterans and active members of the military. Minnesota Congressman Tim Walz talked about it with Tom Cran.
So you were very confident when we talked about its passage. What happened here?
Yeah, I was. And I think because it was, you know, we had done the things necessary. We had built the coalition between families of soldiers who took their life, veterans advocates, and mental health professionals. And over about an 18-month period, we put together a bill that most of those folks, myself included, believed would start to make a difference in this epidemic of veteran suicides. And got it through the House. It's bipartisan. Got over the Senate where we were seeing no resistance. And then at the final moment, a senator stood up and resisted.
Now, I know that you are in the House and more familiar with House rules than Senate, but tell us how that can happen. The Senator, Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma who's also retiring, how does it happen when even Harry Reid, the leader from your party, wanted this to come before a vote in the Senate? How does it get held up by one senator?
Yeah, the senators have what they do, their hold, and this was originally the early part of last week was put on a hold anonymously, so we weren't able to know who was doing it. We finally figured it out, and in fact, Clay Hunt's parents went to Senator Coburn's office to try and get a meeting, which they couldn't, to just ask us to just release the hold so it comes to the floor. So basically what the senator was able to do, and they can do this on any bill, they can do it anonymously, something they don't agree with. They just put a hold on and it doesn't have the ability to come forward. And I understand that certainly, as I said again, I respect that it should be difficult to get laws there, to get them forward. But this arcane rulemaking that allowed, you know, a piece of legislation that went through all of the regular procedures, the senator had 18 months to express any concerns. In fact, the bill was changed fairly dramatically to appease some of the senators. I believe that mine was was better in its comprehensive form in the beginning, but to get it over there, we're willing to make some changes. Not a single word.
He said that the reason is what it does is already funded by the VA. Is there a point there that maybe there is some funding here that could be reallocated for this portioned differently?
Yes, what he's wrong about is we're not asking for new money. The money is already over there. And yes, they're using money in suicide prevention programs. The point of the bill was, though, is I don't think many of those programs are working correctly. So the irony of this is I'm in total agreement with Senator Coburn on this, that this is about bringing efficiencies and effectiveness out of the programs that were there. And so this would have got us the third-party validation that's not there now, and it would have pushed the VA to look into the communities for more peer-to-peer type counseling that some of the newest research that's evolving in mental health and suicide prevention that was written into this bill is showing those are some of the most effective, getting some of these warriors back, getting them some of the training, and using some of the resources in the community to make this happen. And again, I'm not going to make light. It was $22 million, but if you put that up against the $2.3 trillion that have been spent on the war, plus the care that we're going to give these warriors once they come home, and money that had already been allocated.
So what's next year? You told us that you have to start this process over, even though it did pass the House.
We'll bring this thing back up in the House. We'll get it through the subcommittees. We will address any of the concerns that were there, and we'll go through this process again. And I don't know what else we could have done running all the traps and building the coalition necessary, because it's unusual to get a bill, especially in this Congress, to the point that we got it. And the thing that is probably most frustrating with people is that we'll get this thing done. We'll get it signed into law, but it'll probably take us a couple of months. And as we speak, there's going to be families that are going to face incredible heartache and loss that possibly, and I'm certainly not guaranteeing it, I don't know, but there's a possibility, and the experts believe we might have been able to prevent a few of those with this. And again, as I told you earlier, Tom, I thought getting this passed and getting it done keeps the focus on veteran suicide. So I'm going to look at the positive side of this, that Senator Coburn's actions rallied people up across the political spectrum. It got people focusing on this issue again, and we're going to try and highlight that.
Congressman Tim Walz, thank you very much. I appreciate your perspective on this.
Thanks for keeping on this, Tom.
Congressman Walz and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. We close out the podcast with the Minnesota Sounds and Voices production. Kathy Werzer has the intro to that.
Do you have a trip planned soon for a sun-drenched beach? If not, then music made on steel drums or pans could very well be the antidote, the elixir for the winter blahs.
Pan music makes people happy, and it gets something grooving inside of everybody.
The popularity of steel drum music has spread like a prairie fire from its roots in Trinidad and Tobago. In a new episode of Minnesota Sounds and Voices, Dan Olson takes us to a steel drum music hotspot.
The University of Minnesota School of Music in Minneapolis is a nationally respected center for the study of serious music, including steel drum. Every semester, teaching assistant Marilyn Clark Silva leads a steel drum class. It's open to anyone, music major or non-music major. The evolution of the steel drum as a musical instrument has quite a few twists and turns. Clark Silva says it started with slaves on Trinidad and Tobago plantations who wanted to make music. They had to fashion crude instruments from what was available.
They had different lengths of bamboo that they would bang on the ground that would make like a wow, wow sound.
Plantation owners worried the workers used the drumming to communicate and organize a revolt. And then after slavery, worker strikes. Also, competition among the bamboo bands spawned violence, so owners banned the instruments. Workers turned to other objects, including discarded biscuit tins.
On the biscuit tins, as they played them and they became dented, they created different pitches.
Geography is part of the steel drum story. Trinidad and Tobago are near oil-rich Venezuela. Players trimmed oil drums to different sizes, big, deep ones for the bass pan, shorter ones for the lead pan. They used a rock or some other heavy object to pound the top of the oil drum into a bowl. Banging down the oil drum top is mostly unchanged.
You'll just be all day throwing a bowling ball into these oil drums, creating this bowl shape.
Modern steel drums produce all the notes of the musical scale. Areas of the bowl are tuned to create pitches. Tuning the bowl to make different notes evolved into an art. Steel drum player Abby Johnson, a U of M sophomore, says drum head space is limited, so note arrangement is unusual.
They're organized in diminished sevenths per drum, so it doesn't really make sense, but once you learn the roadmap of where all the notes are, it gets a lot easier.
Most steel drums are made to order and cost from $1,000 to $5,000. All kinds of music, pop, classical, carols, have been arranged for steel drum. Somehow the instrument seems best suited, though, to create visions of sun-soaked island beaches. Abby Johnson was smitten with the sound early. She joined her suburban Chicago steel drum band in seventh grade. Johnson has her sights set on a music therapy degree. She says steel drum music chases the gray away.
When you go into rehearsals and you create music, especially with the pans, and it's happy and upbeat, you sort of forget all your gray troubles.
University of Minnesota steel band player Abby Johnson. Dan Olson is our Minnesota Sounds and Voices reporter. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. More tomorrow on the Friday podcast.